Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook.
Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I am your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sunday of every month at 5:30 Pacific Time. So you just make your conversions across the country and across the world. Another Fork in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain-injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anytime, and anywhere. And believe me, it does. For the least little things that you might do, a trip or stumble or fall, can cause a brain injury that can affect your life forever. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States, just the United States, living with some form of brain injury. But most folks don't even know about brain injury, and I know I never did, not until it came to live on my doorstep. So on Another Fork in the Road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and caregivers experience. So on the third Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I host therapists, medical professionals, and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And on the first Sunday of each month, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury. We talk about depression or neural fatigue. We talk about anger or so many of the various symptoms of brain injury. And on our next show on December 6th, the day before my birthday, so bring some noisemakers, folks, because it's not a big one. It's just another ordinary birthday. But anyway, we're going to be talking about getting ready for the holidays, and that's always a sticky subject because it's difficult. And with the pandemic this year, it's even going to be worse. So we're going to discuss that. So let me tell you a little bit about me. For those who might be new to my show, this is just a snippet. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005 when David, my husband, had a brain injury. And you can learn more about that on my blog. Oh, this is where I always remember to say, please have a pencil and paper available, because I often will throw out URLs and you can jot them down and look at them later. Not now, folks, but later. So if you go to my blog, you can find out a little bit more. You can find out a lot about me and my husband, David, at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. You can find out a lot about brain injury there too, and all kinds of things. So I shared David's and my story in 4 episodes on this very show, starting in August of 2014. The last of which was in November of 2014, featured a discussion with David himself. He came on. It took a little tugging and pulling, but I got him on, and he kind of liked it, I think. I also interviewed David on April 19, 2020 of this year. So that was right after the pandemic began, because I wanted to get his perspective on brain injury after his 15 years of living with it. And more importantly, because he is a retired professor of microbiology, and I wanted to get his understanding of the COVID-19 pandemic. So actually, you can find my archive shows on my blog, again, at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Simply click on the air show menu. It's a tab under the category section on the right sidebar, and it's really easy. And all of my shows are listed there. I think I have, oh, I never remember this, and I always say that I never remember it because I never do. But I know I have probably about 125 or 30, I don't know. David will tell me again after the show in 2 weeks. Now I won't remember it again. But anyway, you can find my archive shows. I said that already. So you're going to look for those on Surviving Traumatic Brain Injury on the right sidebar. Or you can, if you want to find out more about David or anybody for that matter, type their name into the search box on the right sidebar to learn more. You can also read our complete story in my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing and released in November of 2018. So it actually just had a birthday. It's 2 years and 15 days old right now. Aw, poor baby. It's really cool. You can find Prisoners, as I so fondly call it, as an ebook and as a print book on all your local book hunts. And I hope to have the audio version of the book completed shortly. So the audio book should be ready by fall, and I hope it was supposed to be ready by summer's end. It was in time for that, but there are little glitches going on with the audiographer and ACX, which does the audible book. So hopefully, cross fingers, folks, the audiobook should be out fairly soon. I'm crossing my fingers, but also not bothering my publisher either. So go to my website, DonnaFigurski.com, to learn more about me. And there is where you can find a lot about Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. So I hope that you're going to find my show tonight fun and informative. And I hope that you'll also visit the shows of the other hosts on the Brain Injury Radio Network. There are shows every night from, from 5:30 p.m. Pacific time. Every night from 7 p.m. Pacific time. And also on the weekends, you can tune in earlier at 5:30 p.m. Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays to listen to your favorite shows, too. And Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States and in 36 countries. So now, sit back, relax, and enjoy tonight's show. And I hope you're going to enjoy it. But did you know, and I bet most of, well, maybe some of you do know, but I know a lot of people don't, that November is National Family Caregivers Month? It is. So it's really fitting to have Harriet Hodgson on my show this evening. Harriet is the caregiver for her husband, John. That status is changing a little bit now, but she's been a caregiver for, I think, most of her life. And so she's going to be sharing a lot of information with us. But she'll be joining me in a few minutes. But first, I'm going to talk a little bit about caregiving. Caregiving, like brain injury, basically, the healing of a brain injury, is a marathon. It's not a sprint. It's a journey, usually down an unexpected pathway with twists and turns and many unexpected forks in the road. Caregiving is strenuous. It's unforgiving and relentless. It demands much of the caregiver, who must relinquish much of the freedom of his or her life. It's pretty tough. I mean, when you're a caregiver, you're in it. You're in it for the long haul. Like brain injury, caregiving is not discriminating. People of every race, creed, nationality, and age are affected. There are caregivers for brain injury survivors and survivors of cancer and diabetes. There are caregivers for Parkinson's and Alzheimer's patients. Mothers and fathers care for their children. And conversely, grown children often care for their elderly parents, flipping that whole equation around because parents are living so much longer these days and requiring care, and so the children oftentimes will step up. Caregiving is not for the faint of heart, yet there are more than 65 million people in the United States who are caregivers. According to the study done by the National Alliance of Caregiving in conjunction with the American Association of Retired Persons, the AARP, you might know that acronym more easily than the full title of them. This study was reported in 2009, and I can only guess that 11-year-old number has risen significantly. I mean, truly. I love this quote by Rosalind Carter. There are only four kinds of people in the world. I wonder where you're going to fall. Think about it. Those who have been caregivers. How many of you out there have been caregivers? Me. Those who are caregivers. Me. Those who will be caregivers. Me. And those who will need caregivers. I hope not me. But which one are you? You know, we don't know. As you get older and older, you might be in need of caregiving. Or if you have an accident or have a serious disease, you might be in need of caregiving. So four kinds of people in the world, it seems that encompasses everybody. So tonight I'm happy to introduce my friend Harriet Hodgson, who has been a health and wellness writer for more than 36 years. Harriet and I share many commonalities. She is a fellow author in the Right Life publishing family, where both of us have books published. A big shout out to Terry Leidick, our publisher. But after reading Harriet's book, The Family's Caregiver Guide, and I have another one here too that I was perusing, A Journal for Family Caregivers, I wanted to have her on the show because I feel like she has written so many more, so many more, that I think she has so much to offer us. We are both caregivers for our husbands who are our best friends. During this show, we'll each discuss our specific caregiving roles and how we incorporate our daily caregiving duties into our normal lives. And normal was in quotes there. What is normal? I mean, really, is there any normal out there anywhere? And on that note, I'm going to say hi to Harriet and welcome you. Harriet Hodgson, author of more than, I had 34 books down in my notes. And during our pre-show talk, Harriet said, nope, it's 42 now. This woman is one prolific writer. 42 books to her name. Wow. Congratulations, Harriet. And many of those books are about caregiving and grief. So, Harriet, I'm so glad you could join me tonight. I'm really pleased to have you here.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, are you ready to get into the tough questions?
I am.
All right. Let's do it. Harriet, before we get into those tough questions or the nitty-gritty, as I say it, can you give us a glimpse into your and your husband John's lives before caregiving became an everyday way of life? What did you both enjoy doing?
Well, we enjoyed traveling. We enjoyed reading the same books and discussing them. We enjoyed various hobbies. He was a fly fisherman, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we liked to go antiquing, although we kind of got over that. But this is my 23rd year as a family caregiver.
Wow.
Five care.
Yeah, we're going to go. Yeah. I was going to say, we're going to go into more of those different angles of your caregiving in just a moment. But yeah, did you each have a career? Now, obviously, your career, you're an author, you're a book writer, and that must take up most of your time. And you, actually, I want to go back a second because you mentioned John was a fly fisherman. What did you do that was fun?
Oh, I love
I sit
to cook.
At the computer and write. Oh, okay.
I love to decorate. I love to read. And I love to write. So
I had plenty
of things. I started out as a teacher, and I taught for a dozen years. And then I started writing articles, and they were published in teaching journals. And I thought, boy, this is fun, and there's my name in print. So I, you know, retired from teaching to start writing. And that was many years ago. And so I'm still at it, still writing. And in many respects, it's my sanity. I write to figure things out a lot of times.
Uh-huh. That makes a lot of sense, too. And that's another commonality I just learned. I didn't realize that you were a teacher in your earlier years, as was I. So, and I
know.
Did it. I started, you know, I love teaching, absolutely love teaching. But when I started writing, I started off doing picture books, children's picture books, and just got so involved in that until David had his brain injury, and then everything twisted and turned in our lives. And I went forward and writing the book about him, which I had no intention of ever doing, but it somehow happened. And fortunately, our publisher, Terry Leidick, supported me, and here we are today. So that is wonderful. But I also go to writing, not so much to figure things out generally for me, but more to, because I have to figure out what's happening to other characters, because I am back to picture book writing as well as another book on teaching. So I hope that'll come out eventually. But so Harriet, you mentioned you've been a caregiver for most of your life, and you were a caregiver for your mother. Then you became a caregiver guardian for your twin grandchildren. And finally, you've been the caregiver for your husband, John, who is also disabled. Can you share, Harriet, with our audience, how you became the caregiver for so many years?
Well, I think life determined that. You know, things happen, and my mother had vascular dementia, and finally it became clear that I had to move her to Minnesota. She lived in Florida, and when she moved to Minnesota, I became her family caregiver. And although she lived in a retirement community, I was very involved in her life. I mean, I did something with her or for her virtually every day of the week. And so that went on for 9 years. And then in 2007, my elder daughter died from the injuries she received in a car crash. And several months later, the twins' father died from the injuries he received in another car crash, so that my husband and I were suddenly appointed by the court as our twin grandchildren's guardians. And it was a difficult time because other people died in 2007. My brother died and my father-in-law died. So I was grieving for four people, but trying to stay upbeat for 15-year-old teenagers, and it wasn't easy. And I relived the teenage years. You know, we were at gymnastics meets, and we were at high school plays and marching band concerts and all sorts of things. And I kept on writing, though. I thought, you know, I can write as these things are happening in my life. And basically, that's where the caregiving books began.
Oh, wow. Okay, so then I guess I'd like to know, how can you talk about the similarities between each of your different situations of caregiving and the differences required by each of those roles?
Well,
when you're doing your mom.
First of all, my mother had been brilliant, but a series of mini strokes, damaged her mind. And as her physician said, it equaled Alzheimer's, although it was vascular dementia. So eventually she started doing odd things. I had to put her in the nursing wing of her retirement community because she called me one night in the middle of a blizzard and said she was going to run away. So she wound up in nursing care, and when she was there, she started taking things from other people's rooms and wandering, not being able to track. She lost the ability to recognize my voice, which was interesting because she could remember the number. She could call our phone number, But when I answered, she didn't think it was me, and so she would hang up. And then she said, well, you're never home. Well, I got all the those calls, but she didn't realize it. Well, then with the grandchildren, as I've already indicated, you know, we went through the teenage years. Frankly, I wondered if I had the strength. Do I have the strength at age 72 to do this? And then I thought, well, I have to have the strength. I don't have a choice. So I kind of gave myself a little pep talk. But the kids were wonderful. My twin grandchildren are fraternal twins, one boy, one girl, and they were just wonderful. And later on, years later, my grandson said that he was so grateful that he had a place to live and so grateful that we, you know, were his caregivers. In 2013, my husband's aorta dissected. And so that was a completely different situation. He already had a Dacron descending aorta, but the connection between that and the real aorta severed. And he had three operations. And during the last one, he suffered a spinal cord injury, but which isn't surprising because he'd already had surgery to have the Dacron descending aorta installed. So when he woke up, he couldn't move his limbs at all. But then slowly the feeling came back in both arms and one leg, but not the other. There's some feeling, but it couldn't support him. So the difference with caring for John is that I was caring for someone who was paraplegic. We had been very active together. We loved traveling, and I couldn't help but think that because I married an adventurer, a specialist in aviation and aerospace medicine. We walked on the Great Wall of China. We had been in and seen the pyramids in Egypt. You know, we had really traveled to many places. And during his medical career, he was also the medical director of Northwest Airlines for a number of years. And in case you're wondering, we did not fly free. We flew on the Hodgson checkbook plan.
We
did get to see the world. But caring for someone who was disabled is a whole new ballgame. And paraplegia means that from the waist down that you are not functioning properly. So I had to learn things that I never dreamed I would have to learn. I had to learn sterile technique. I had to learn how to catheterize. Eventually, my husband had a stoma to help clear waste from his body, so I had to learn stoma care. I had to learn how to use medical equipment, such as a stand-aid frame. And so basically, in my mind, I was earning a nursing degree the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
And
Go ahead,
Donna.
I totally understand that. Go ahead. Finish what you're thinking, because
so
I'm going to throw you off.
It was a really tiring day. And I realize now, looking back, that basically I was sleep deprived much of the time. But, you know, we kept chugging along, and we moved from our three-level home into a town home, and then eventually we moved into a retirement community, and we've been here 1 year. But my husband's health is failing, and he has advanced prostate cancer, which has spread to many bones in his body. He also has a heart flutter and various other problems, and so he's very frail, and he begins hospice care next week. So my role has changed, and this will happen to all caregivers. As your loved one's health changes, your role may change. You have more tasks. Others may be eliminated. As your own health changes, your caregiving will change. And during the pandemic, I thought it was interesting. We needed things like antiseptic wipes, for example. But mm-hmm. we couldn't find them. They were all sold out.
Yeah.
So I had to make my own solution, diluting alcohol and putting that in bottles, you know. And I'm, so mm-hmm. I never thought I would be doing that. And I also
yeah.
did medication management. And now with my husband starting hospice care, I realize my role has changed yet again. And so I may not be the hands-on caregiver, but I am still a caregiver. I am still monitoring, and I am very much now his advocate. So that is
right.
A resumed role. I've been in that role before. But it's a role I have resumed, and it's not easy. It's difficult. And then to make life interesting, I tested positive for COVID a few weeks ago. So I have been in quarantine. But that was a good chance to have some creative ideas. And so while I've been quarantined, I've written 3 grief, hope, and healing books for children is one thing.
Not
that
to
I've
waste
done.
Any time, right?
No.
Not to waste any time, Harriet.
No, well, I don't think I have much time to waste. So I figure, well, I'll just get cracking here. And
yeah.
I'm so excited about one of them because I have a master's degree in art education. And it will be the first book that I have written and illustrated. So I'm excited about that. Yeah, and I've gotten wonderful editorial reviews from grief experts. So that one is called Grief Doodling, Bringing Back Your Smiles. And it tells kids how they can use doodling to process feelings and start to have hope again.
Sounds
so
wonderful.
I'm not bored, Donna. I can tell you that I'm not bored.
Oh, I never doubted that you would be. Not with when you have 42 books in 30 some years. No, I don't think so. But you know, that's the beauty of being a writer too, and being able to focus on something like that, because you can't be bored. I tell David all the time, I could never be bored. I have too many things on my to-do list to do, you know, just with the different things of writing. So, and I think that's actually been a blessing during the pandemic, because I
yes.
know that a lot of people are stuck in their homes and they can't go out and do the fun things that they wanted to do or go to the grocery store. I mean, that's something I'm looking forward to now, going to the grocery
uh-huh.
store. What a fun thing. But, you know, I haven't done that. I haven't done it in whatever it's been, more than 250 days we've been isolating, other than picking up, you know, just doing a pickup for groceries a couple
uh-huh.
of times during this time. You know, but so I think other people might be chomping at the bit to just get out and do things. And I thought I would be one of them. I thought I would never be able to last a week in a quarantine situation, in a, you know, a self-isolation situation. But it hasn't affected me at all. I never even think about it, which is weird, because I am always busy, you know, writing, you know. And that's
yes.
what you're doing, and I think that helps us. You know, fortunately, that does give us an out to get by through this. It's interesting.
Well, the other thing,
David,
Donna, the other thing that happened is an organization in town made a video, and I talked to people about the fun there is in doodling, and I tell them that, you know, it would be good to do during isolation. You can become a doodling family, and I demonstrated
uh-huh.
techniques, and it worked out very well. So I think there's an application for that. So.
Uh-huh. You know, it's funny that David tells me, Donna, this is nothing new for me. You know, this isolation thing is, he feels he doesn't notice any difference in his life, other than the fact that we would always go out to dinner on Friday night. We always went to dinner on Friday, always went to dinner after my show on Sundays. So that's twice a month there, and occasionally during the week here and there. Other than doctor's appointments, that was his life. His life really revolved in just being in the house. And so he said, this isn't any different for me. You know, he's not feeling the pandemic stress that other people were feeling because he doesn't see any difference. I thought, like I said, I thought I was going to be a mess, but I'm fine. I'm doing really well with it. I'm surprised. I will be glad when it's over. There's no question about that. But, yeah, and I think that's something, you know, it's a benefit for us because we have that. Now, I wanted to say when we were talking about the similarities and the differences required by each of your caregiving duties, I guess. They're all different in a way because your mother, you were dealing with dementia. With your grandchildren, you were dealing with the teenage years. Holy moly, that's enough. You know, and then
that is a holy moly.
and then double trouble because you had two of them, so you've got like them coming at both at you at the same time. And then with John having the paraplegic, and that must have been much more physical caregiving as well as maybe more emotional too, because he is your partner, your best friend. And I find that with me, I think that's the hardest part, is that things changed because of David's brain injury and everything changed. And that becomes a much more emotional caregiving thing. And so I was just wondering how you felt about that. Which one of those, and I know it's hard to pick one, but which one do you think was the most difficult for you?
Well, I haven't quite determined that. I'm going to find out, I think, fairly soon whether the death of a child, the mother of my grandchildren, whether the death of a child is more painful than the death of a husband. We are blessed to have been married 63 years, and that doesn't include the 4 years we went together. So I have known John more than any human being on earth, and it's going to be hard, you know, that change. I'm trying to stay upbeat. Fortunately, I know that I am feeling anticipatory grief. I did feel anticipatory grief when I was caring for my mother, and actually I spent 12 years writing a book about anticipatory grief. Called Smiling Through Your Tears. But now I'm feeling anticipatory grief again. It's a little bit more acute, I think. I'm prepared in some ways because I've been through this, and in other ways I'm unprepared. But again, I have to think of my blessings. I mean, although I tested positive for COVID-19, I haven't developed any symptoms, and that is a blessing. When I look at the statistics and when I look at the number of deaths, I think, wow,
yes.
I am so fortunate. I am fortunate to still be writing, and every day I get up with excitement about, you know, being in the book business and writing or editing, or right now I'm outlining a book. So that's exciting for me, and I have things to look forward to. I mean, I have two books coming out in the new year, so that's exciting. I hope that my husband is still alive and can share in that joy, but he may not when the time comes. But I think, again, caregivers are constantly adjusting. One similarity I found is that you, if you're a caregiver, you basically are in isolation. Because friends, I mean, they were sympathetic, but they disappeared. And and how could they be close by, nearby, when I was caring for teenagers, you know? I mean, that took all of my days and all, took over my life. Same thing with caring for John. So I tried to stay in touch with reliable websites. I tried to stay in touch with others by writing a series of four books about caregiving. I just realized that you have to work hard to combat isolation. And I don't know, I found out some friends, you know, were doing things and I used to be invited, but then I wasn't invited anymore because they knew I couldn't come. And that made me feel badly. You know, it would have been nice to at least have gotten the invitation. I used to have a Christmas luncheon every year for my friends. I had to stop doing that. So my life changed. It's still a rewarding life, and it's still a very loving life, but it is different. So, and the pandemic didn't help.
No, it didn't. But I think the pandemic made other people understand a little bit more what caregivers and people who are involved in a serious disease feel. Interesting enough, what was I going to say about that? When you were talking about being isolated from friends, this is a woe that brain injury survivors mentioned constantly to me. It's the losing the family. It's the losing the friends. Now, we're talking about it from the caregiver point of view, and that's actually the same, pretty much the same thing, because if you are a caregiver that is really involved, you aren't. For 5 years, I was so involved with David, I didn't do anything. I didn't go out with anybody. Well, I never do anyhow, but I was, you know, I was still I would still see some people and things like that. But it was like, that was gone. It's because he needed me. I needed to be there with him. And that was enough for me. But after 5 years, I was able to get back out again. That's not happening with a lot of people. I was able to go back into the theater. I was able to take walks with girlfriends and things like that. And that was good. But I can understand a lot of people, that doesn't happen for, and it can become a very lonely and upsetting situation because, like you said, you had all these people that were there, and I'm sure in the beginning of the situation of your event, when John had his major problem, or when, you know, during all this, all the time for each caregiving event, they were there for you, to support you, and then pretty soon they're gone. And that's pretty much normal, I think, in so many situations, because I know for David, when he had his brain injury, of course, it was an event that just happened, a spontaneous event. One day everything was fine, the next day it's not, or 1 minute even, for that matter. And people came in, and people supported me, and they were there to help me out and get through this for about 4 days, 3 days. And then they went back to their homes, and it's normal. You know, it's natural. They have to go back to their homes. Their lives are not put on hold like mine was or like David's was, but they did lend the support, and then they went back to their lives, to their jobs, to their families. And so it's understandable, but it becomes very disheartening, I think, for the caregiver or for the survivor. In this case, David had no clue. But for me, yeah, I was like, trying to, you know, do everything I needed to do with no help at all. And then, of course, like you're saying, your friends go on with their lives and they have their parties and their luncheons and everything, and you're not involved anymore, and there's no more phone call or email saying, hi, how are you doing? And it's really, really difficult. So I'm just saying, you know, the reason I'm expounding on this is because I think for people out there, you're hearing this and you are know somebody that's a caregiver or a survivor of any sort of thing. And I know we're a brain injury radio network, but we're also talking about caregiving, and that's an umbrella for everybody, because a caregiver has the same types of duties no matter what the situation, no matter how your survivor is pigeonholed in what he or she has. It's still, the caregiver is kind of still overall umbrella doing all the grunt work and everything that everything needs to be done so that the care recipient can have a better life. So yeah, it's really a difficult thing that kind of thing happens. And I was fortunate after 5 years to be able to, David was well enough, although he was, because he's cognitively fine, his balance is very challenged, and he cannot leave the house without me. That's why I say the pandemic was not so much different for him, because he really couldn't go out by himself anyhow. But I was able to get out myself once he was able to be a little more, had more stability in the house. But a lot of people don't get that. I'm lucky to have that happening with me. So I want to go back a little bit, Harriet. You recently told me that since John needs more care than you are physically able to offer, you are no longer his actual caregiver, his physical caregiver. But you said that your role has morphed into more a patient advocate for him. And I want to delve into that a little bit. Being an advocate is so important for folks needing care because they are usually not able to fight for themselves, to ask anything for themselves, to take care of even the most minute problems that they might have. So I was just wondering, now I know that John is living on a different floor in your community and being cared for there, and you are in your apartment on, you know, floors away. Can you tell us how the role of being John's advocate impacts you, and what kinds of duties does an advocate have in your view?
Well, first of all, it was a pretty abrupt transition because John and I, I would say 6 weeks ago, we thought we might have gotten COVID, and we both had the same symptoms, and we felt so awful. So we took his and her ambulances to the emergency department, and we've each, in that time interval, gone to the ED, it's called, three times by ambulance. So that's six times.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if insurance is going to be paying for that, so that's going to be horrendously pricey if they don't. The other thing is I'm paying for two residences. I'm paying for our apartment, and I'm paying for his care on another floor, so that's horrendously expensive. But finally, the retirement community, with permission, it's owned and operated by Mayo. Following Mayo guidelines, they thought that they would try a little experiment, and you can call a phone number and make an appointment to visit. So my daughter came from the Twin Cities, and she drove to our town, and we both visited John. I noticed some nurses were not very professional with him. I noticed that it didn't even say there's a whiteboard, you know, that talks about treatment and they put notes. Yeah. And they didn't even say Dr. Hodgson. My daughter couldn't stand it, and she went and erased Mr. and put in Doctor.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of an abrupt change when we came home from the hospital. And then I realized that it had to be a thoughtful change. You have to be very careful. I mean, you in many respects have to be as tactful as an ambassador. So finally, I had some grievances, and I came back to my apartment now, and I wrote a very carefully worded but a very strong email. And I sent it to the director of the retirement community, and I sent it to the director of nursing. And because of that email, they consulted with each other, and they decided that even though no visitors were allowed, I could visit John if I followed rules very carefully. Well, then after that, I realized that I still had some grievances. I met with a social worker. A manager said, well, do you want to file a grievance report? I did decide to file one report, but again, I came back to my apartment, and I wrote a list of suggestions to improve care. And I said at the end that I share these ideas with you because I am John's wife and I am also his advocate, that we have been married 63 years and I will not fail him as his life draws to a close.
Mm-hmm.
So I realize that we have to be tactful. You have to speak in a calm voice, no shouting, no accusations.
Mm-hmm.
Stick with the facts. I realized I have to take notes on some of the things, like some of the phone
mm-hmm.
calls. I write up the information. I put notes on the calendar in the hospital. You know, I note those times. I have to check
mm-hmm.
bills very carefully because I'm getting very large bills for my husband's care. And I even... out of concern, consulted our lawyer and consulted our financial advisor to make sure that we could deal with these issues. So there is a lot to being an advocate. I've also tried humor because sometimes you can't get through to someone, and I think you know this very well, Donna, because you can be very funny. I think sometimes humor gets you through to people who ordinarily wouldn't receive your message. And
mm-hmm.
they remember the laugh. And then they remember
mm-hmm.
you. And then they think, maybe that person is a nice person and they're not being difficult. They're just showing their love for their family member. So there are lots of things to consider when you are an advocate. And if you think you need to, keep a log of some important things and note the dates. And it doesn't have to be long. You can say,
mm-hmm.
met with the head nurse, whatever, because you won't remember everything, especially if you're stressed and especially if you're in anticipatory grief. So that log could be very helpful later. So there
mm-hmm.
are a lot of things that I am doing. I haven't been out of my apartment for a while. And I hope next Wednesday we'll end this quarantine and maybe I'll be allowed to, go out in the halls and stuff and visit my husband again.
Mm-hmm. Harriet, you just brought back so many memories of my hospital days with David, because I was doing exactly what you were doing with keeping the notes. I also had a notebook that I was jotting things down in constantly. I was digitally recording after a doctor or nurse or therapist talked to me. I would digitally record what they told me so that I wouldn't forget it, because otherwise you're right. You're going to forget. And you're not going to know it, and you're not going to know when it happened, and somebody's going to say to you, so when did you talk to so-and-so about that, or when did that incident happen? And I could go open my notebook and say, it happened on this date at this time, because otherwise there's no way. Your whole mind is flooded with so many things that are going on as you are actually in a hospital caring for your loved one. And, so I thought that just brought back so many memories. And your talk about the laugh, you can gather more, what do they say, you can gather more people with honey than you can gather, what is that one? I forget. I always get these things wrong.
I don't remember.
you can get further with honey than vinegar. Honey is more sweeter than, I don't know what it is. But everybody out there who's out there laughing because I'm totally making a fool of myself, you will get it. You know what I'm talking about. Honey gathers more, friends than vinegar would. And, I always made friends with the doctors, with the nurses, with the therapists, the aides. Oh, my gosh. Please pay attention to your aides in the hospital, in your rehab hospitals, anywhere. They are golden. They are so helpful to you if you make that connection. And they've got the lowliest of jobs there. They're the ones that are emptying, doing the grunt work, as I like to say it, the not so pleasant duties that have to be done for patients. And so when you appreciate them, they appreciate you too. I made friends with most of David's. I can't say every one of them, but most of them were. I had the aides coming up to visit me on there. If they weren't assigned to David on a day, they'd come up to see him and me on a break. You know, it was just so nice. And, you know, you get better care that way. So, yeah, when you say keep a calm voice and when you're talking, you're not going to, if you're yelling at somebody about something, I don't care what it is, they're going to shut down. They're not going to hear you. But if you talk in a normal, gentle voice and get your message across, you'll get a whole lot farther. And again, humor. You mentioned that too, Harriet. Humor. Have laughs with your doctors and your nurses. I did all the time. It didn't always work. I had one doctor in David's rehab that never listened to me. He would just smile and say, yes, 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 and he'd talk over me, and he heard me, but he didn't listen. And there are two different skills. He never listened. And so it was really complicated with him. I made him listen, though. Finally, he listened, and I got what I needed for David. But, it's when you also bite off the big chunks. Let the little things go. But the big chunks are what you need to work on. When something is happening, like you said, you had to problems with his John's care. Yeah, you're definitely going to talk about that. If there are things going down that aren't working well for you, I had a nurse fired off of David's care. She made major mistakes. And if you want to know what they are, read the book. But she made major mistakes with him. And the first time I kind of let it go. The second time I said, oh, no, this is never happening again, never. And I had her off the case, no faster than lightning, you know, because she's not going to hurt my husband. No. And what you said, Harriet, you know, you've been with John for 63 years plus, and you are going to be the one. You are his advocate. You are his caregiver. You are the person in charge that, because he can't take that charge now. And so you have to be the one that is being his spokesperson. And that's what a good advocate does, I think. And that's, you know, that's where I was for the longest time. David has a voice now. He can do a lot more. But still, I oftentimes will step up if I need to. I will make sure that his care in the doctor's offices or, you know, that the doctor's understanding, especially a new doctor, you know, understanding where we're coming from, where David's coming from, who he is, too. You know, that's it's another thing, you know. This is just not a body in a bed. You know, this is a person with loved people, people who love him.
Well, the other thing, Donna, you cued me on something. In addition to using humor, I have been doing a one-sentence compliment. So, and you talk about listening. We finally, when John was not on another floor, when we moved into our apartment together, I hired a registered nurse to come in every morning and help get him up. And she was wonderful to him and so respectful. And so I know one day I said to her, thank you for the gift of listening, because it is a gift. And people don't listen very well. So the one-sentence compliment, and it has to be sincere, but the one-sentence compliment has worked very well, and people feel appreciated. You don't have to go on at length. They don't have the time anyway. Uh-huh.
Exactly.
But you know, they will remember the one sentence that you said. So it's worth
absolutely
doing.
Absolutely. And you know, that one sentence is going to work, is just going to buy you so much compassion and empathy for your loved one when you're not there. And can't be, I mean, I was there pretty much 15, 16 hours a day until David came home for 3 months. But, you know, there are times that I wasn't there yet in the morning or something. And yet then those people, those nurses or those aides know that you really, really care for this person. And somehow that also gives them that feeling too, that there is that respect or there is that import that comes with that. This person's important, you know, and I'm sure that they feel that way about all their patients, but, you know, they're in an assembly line almost. I'm running to this room, to this room, to this room, to this room. There's a body in the bed in this room, in this room, in this room, and they have to take care of it. But you don't want to be a body in the bed. You want to be a person in the bed, you know, with a personality. And that's what, you know, if the person is in a situation like David was, in a coma, or not able to communicate in the very beginning, I needed to be that person who would make that connection. And I think that is so important, and that's for anybody out there, being a caregiver, being an advocate, being whatever. And then that takes me to this, Harriet. I wonder what happens to the patients who have no advocates, no family or no friends who can stand up for them or make important decisions about their health care, or and ask the unending questions of healthcare professionals. Because I saw so many people in David's brain injury ward that had nobody there ever. There were some people that were there all the time, and I got to know them too. I got to know the other families of the, I call them the inmates. The people in the ward, you know, it wasn't a ward, in the floor. But, I mean, it's like the people that were living there because of their injury, the patients. So, you know, that was another thing too. You just want to make that kind of a connection. So, but who intercedes with the insurance companies for folks with no advocates? I know my husband David said he would have been lost in the system. He would have fallen between the cracks at the mercy of the medical field if I weren't there to oversee and fight for his care, as I said about the nurse I removed from his care. David would have, I'm getting all confused here. For much time where he was in that coma, and when he wasn't even like cognizant enough. I mentioned that earlier, to know what was going on. So this is not uncommon for many hospital or rehab patients. And so what do you think about that? How do people deal with that? Well, you just mentioned, Harriet, all these things about taking care of the bill, taking care of the insurance. That brings back panic attacks to me, really. Because that was probably the worst part of this whole thing for me as a person, was the trying to figure out what's going on with who's asking for what. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of people do fall through the cracks. But one thing is, most hospitals, maybe not a small hospital, but most normal, quote, end quote, and large hospitals do have a patient advocate on staff. And a lot of families do not realize that. But you should be able to contact that patient advocate at any time. You should also find out if there are social workers who work on that unit. Sometimes there are social workers assigned to specific floors in hospitals. So you should ask about that. You might also ask local religious communities. They may have volunteers who would be willing to support you. I know many years ago a patient came to our Rochester. I live in Rochester, Minnesota, and they came to Rochester for care. And they showed up at our church, and she showed up before surgery. So I knew when she was going to have surgery, and I made it a point to go visit her. And so she didn't feel so alone. She had, you know, come a great distance, and I thought, well, you know, that's something that I can do for her. And I took her some magazines and eventually had her for lunch and stuff like that. So you might find help in a church. And then the other thing is, you can always call the county government and ask if they have any help available. I know when my mother's health was failing, there were some social workers who came from the county to kind of check on her condition, and they gave me excellent advice. It was painful advice, but it was excellent. And they said, pay for your mother's cremation now. Make all the arrangements, pay the bills, and then when she dies, it will be easier for you and it will be done. And I followed that advice, and I was so glad I did, because, you know, you can expect their death, but it's still a great jolt when it happens.
Yeah.
So there is help available, but people have to know about it. And if you go, like in your situation, Donna, you know, you might have told some other families that, you know, this kind of help is available from this agency or whatever. You know, we can pass on information that may be helpful.
Right. And I think that's where I'm in a situation where I can do that now, both in my blog and on the radio show. But you
exactly.
know what? When it was happening to me, I was in total oblivion. I had no idea. And in the rehab, there was no advocate. There was no social worker that ever approached me. At Columbia, there was Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, now New York Presbyterian. I did have a social worker contacting me when David needed to be moved to a rehab. But she wasn't much help, frankly, because she knew the rehab hospitals in New York, and we lived in New Jersey, which is just 8 miles away from the hospital or less, and she had no real information about that. So I was really stuck in on my own. But, yeah, so it's hard if you don't have somebody that can – I mean, I needed an advocate for me. You know, David needed me to advocate for him, and I needed an advocate for me to get me through all this. And unfortunately, I had no one. I had to really figure this out on my own. My kids were there for a little bit of time during the that move over to New Jersey to the rehab hospital, and they were helpful in that situation. But other than that, forget it. It was David who was sleeping the sleep of the peaceful there in his coma. And me trying to figure it all out. And it's scary, folks. It's really scary. And there's no real solution. I can't offer you that solution. But, you know, just keep talking. Talk to your doctor. Talk to your nurses. See what they can offer you. Say ask for that. But who would have known? I didn't. I surely didn't know to ask for an advocate or to talk to anybody about that. So, yeah, it's scary. So, this is another thing I wanted to talk to you about, Harriet, because you said you are finally realizing the all importance of self-care. Now that John has moved in on another floor and is having his caregiving duties, being taken care of basically by somebody else, and you are not the primary caregiver right now. I think that many caregivers are in the midst of caregiving for their loved ones, often put themselves on the back burner. I know I did. They forget to take care of themselves. Frankly, in reality, they often can't find the time to take care of themselves. And I would put myself in that category for 5 years. I'm in a different situation now, but for about 5 years, it was nothing but focusing on David. You know, he did go back to work. I went back to work, but when we were home, it was my thinking about David and taking care of him and worrying about everything that he needed and trying to make his life easier, basically, because it was hard. It was really hard for him to be limited in his movement, and his speech was difficult. He had so many issues. And so I wanted to make it easier for him, so I would do, and I just kept doing. And so I wasn't really taking care of myself. And let's see. So my day or anybody's day in caregiving, the busy day of caring for their care recipient, doing household chores, fitting in the errands, paying bills, caring for children, which in my case I didn't have because mine were grown at that point, and perhaps juggling a day job. And everything else there was mine except for the children who were grown. Simply doesn't allow room for bubble baths or a cup of teas or a sprint around the block or a 5-minute read. It just didn't happen. So those simple deeds are so needed, and the list can go on and on, and I'm sure you could add tons of those things. But so, Harriet, what are you doing to help yourself face each morning now? And I think I know with the writing, but are you doing any more little things just to take care of Harriet?
I am, and it's interesting. The whole doodling thing was kind of odd because I had written kind of a workbook for grieving children, and I submitted it to a very reputable company, and the CEO said, you know, Harriet, this is two books together. Please separate them, and I did that, which took some work, and I had to adjust the language. I had to adjust the activities. And then when it came time to illustrate it, she said, well, this book is being illustrated with doodle art. And I thought, well, my goodness, I have a master's degree in art education. I've never heard of doodle art. And, of course, the reason I'd never heard of doodle art was I'd been caregiving for 23 years. So
oh,
I started researching it. And then I thought, well, you know, I have training in a lot of these techniques. So I started doodling. And what was amazing to me is that when I was doodling, and I would doodle for about a half hour, I would be so absorbed that all of my problems would fade away. I wouldn't think of anything else but the doodle. And I did doodling pictures, and then I went on the net, and I tried to copy some of the techniques. And then when my husband had a long appointment with his doctor, I didn't bring a novel. I didn't bring a magazine. I brought a sketchbook, and I doodled, and I was totally absorbed. And so as a stress reliever, I began doodling, and that's when I realized how helpful it could be for grieving children. So that's where that book came from. And when I think about it now, I hate to admit this, but I wrote it in a week. I was almost
in a
trance. Yeah, I was really almost in a trance when I wrote the book. And it's one of the books that I am proudest of because I deal with very complex points in very simple words. And then that's the one I've also illustrated. So I haven't doodled in a few days. I'm also doing something called Japanese Enzo circles. I think Enzo is the correct pronunciation. It's E-N-S-O. And you may have heard of that. But so you get some ink, black ink, and you get a brush, and you meditate for a few minutes. And then you take a breath, inhale, take in a breath, and you draw a circle with one stroke, and then you exhale. And so I started doing that, and my Enzo circles, which they are affiliated with Buddhism, and I'm not a Buddhist, but I found it very beneficial, and they were not very circular. They were kind of oval, and then I tried different size brushes, and then I tried different wetness. And so I do an Enzo each day. So, that involves some meditation.
Uh-huh.
And what's interesting to me is I realize that the circle will never be perfect, but it's useful. And then some people, this is very common in Japan, they draw more circles inside circles. And I met a friend on the internet, and she adds calligraphy and meaningful words such as peace or kindness in the middle of her circle. So I'm doing that. I'm continuing to write. I had a stack of books that I had wanted to read, and, you know, I tackled them, read several. Of all things, I'm reading now a book about crows' brains. Now, did I ever think I was going to read a book about crows' brains? No. But our city has a big crow problem. And it's not very helpful for people downtown. They litter park benches, they litter cars, sidewalks, all of that. Well, now that I'm reading this book and I'm halfway through, I have more appreciation of the crow. And I understand why the crow has survived for centuries, and it has. So I'm reading books, and then I think I'm going to start writing affirmations again. I think it's very helpful. And when you are in a situation like mine, it is very important to eat a balanced diet. I'm doing that. I am cooking for myself. And I'm not doing slapdash meals. I'm doing good meals. I'm spending quiet time in reflection each day. So the only thing that's missing is that I haven't had physical activity in this apartment. I can do a few exercises, but I really should be out there walking, which I have been unable to do. So those are some of the things.
Well, it sounds like you've got it pretty well covered. You're doing a good job there.
Well, and
because
it's
so important.
I do tap into one website that I also write for. It's called the caregiverspace.org. It's nonprofit. It's a very good website with very good caregiving articles. And the best thing of all is they're not trying to sell you something all the time. It's really trying to serve professional and family caregivers.
So I want to say that again. That's caregiverspace.org. I did look it up, and I have been reading some of the articles there in point yours. But so that brings me a couple of things I'm wanting to get in the next 4 minutes. But I don't think I'll ever get them all done. So anyhow, I just wanted to briefly say about me time stones. That's another thing for folks out there. What I always do is I carry a me time stone. It's just a little black polished stone. And I have them all over the house. They're by my computer on the table, by the bathroom, by my bedside, in pockets. And many of them have gone through the washing machine many times. Because they're there for me. Whenever I see one, and I carry it on me if I have a pocket too, whenever I see one, I remember it's time to do something for me. I need to do something for me, even if it is that cup of tea or something like that. And I could be having a cup of tea while I'm writing, but as long as it's something that I want to do or a little walk down the street, you know, because it's so important. We get so lost in caring for our loved ones, our care recipients, that we don't do for us. And you know, I always like to say, as airline attendants say, in case of cabin pressure change, put on your own mask first and then help others. Because if you don't have your mask on, if you're not caring for you, you're not going to have the energy or the wherewithal to do it for anybody else. So take care of you first, and then and you'll have a lot more to give to your care recipient. Harriet, on that caregiver space, I noticed you talked about, and these are just little things I want to just bring up because I think they would be great for other people to use as well as little things to get yourself by and very interesting things. And one of them was your happiness jar. I think that's what you called it. And
yes.
I thought that was really, that was really interesting where you write something down every day that was positive. You know, so something just positive, drop it in a jar. You could do it in a journal. You could do it anywhere you want like that,
well,
in a box
and it was,
or whatever.
It was specifically a caregiving happiness jar. So
I
would write something positive about my caregiving. For example, when John finally went for therapy after being hospitalized for months, and then kind of almost bedridden for a year, he finally went for physical therapy, and I thought, well, they won't be able to do anything, and they did. And they got him up on a zero gravity, held him up with a strap and everything, and said, now you're going to try practice walking. And they filmed it and everything, and I put that, on a piece of paper, practiced walking today, put that in the happiness jar. Or if he said he really liked dinner, that went in the happiness jar. So it helped me focus on the positives of caregiving.
Right. And then after maybe a year or after some time, you open them up and read them, and it brings back all these fun memories of what you were doing with your husband or whoever your caregiver, care recipient is. So, yeah, I really liked that idea. Yeah. So I want to just mention, too, again, because we are going to be tying up loose strings right now, but I want to mention the couple of books. And like I said, Harriet's got 42 books, but these are two books that I have. The Family Caregiver's Guide, which I actually had Harriet on a show in March. So if you want to hear her talk about talk more about family caregiving, and in particular, a lot of the aspects in this book. And if you look at it, it looks like it was in a college class because it's got all kinds of post-it notes all over it. It's called The Family Caregiver's Guide. Really good book. And another book, A Journal for Family Caregivers, pretty much gives you little affirmations, gives you affirmations, and then you get to write about that. Think about it. And so it kind of gets your thoughts out. And I think both of those books are really valuable. But, Harriet, where can folks find more of your books?
Well, they're all on Amazon. So in that four-book series, I also wrote Affirmations for Family Caregivers and the Family Caregivers Cookbook. Because I realized I was not eating properly, like dinner was a bowl of cereal, and I thought I know better than this. So I wrote a cookbook. I used to write a cooking column for a newspaper, so that was easy. And so those four books comprise a series from Bright Life, and thanks to Terry Leidick for believing in them all.
Yes, that's great. So check out Amazon, or I should just say your local book hunt. Any your favorite book hunt could be on online or stores once we can get back into the stores. And look for Harriet Hodgson, H-O-D-G-S-O-N, and your website, harriethodgson.com, I believe.
Yes.
Okay, so there you go, folks. And on that note, I'm going to say to Harriet, thank you so, so much for joining me tonight. I had such a great time chatting
with you
again. Yeah. So,
Thanks, Donna.
You're welcome, Harriet. You can always learn more about Harriet from my blog, SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. If you go there, just put in her name and you will find her show. If you put in her name, you're going to find her show. So just go do that. But it will be under the category of on the air show menu. You can also read other interviews of TBI survivors and caregivers on my blog. Again, SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. There's a lot of stuff there. There are so many things there that you could spend days there. You could get lost in it. So anyhow, go give it a try, and I'm not going to go through everything that's there because you can look for it. So you can read more about my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, both at DonnaFigurski.com, and there's a cast of characters. You can see all the main characters in the book, and it gives you a little more personalized view of the book. On my next show, which is the day before my birthday, December 6th. My birthday is the 7th, and December 6th is the show, 3 weeks from now. We will be talking about preparing for the holidays. And for people who are chronically ill with brain injury or any of the other kinds of injuries, diseases that are going out there, this is a really hard time of the year, very hard time of the year, starting with all the holidays. Halloween, Thanksgiving, the winter holidays, all the way through New Year's. So we're going to be talking about that with my panel. And so I hope that you'll join me then. And as I always say, if you liked my show, tell 10 of your friends. If you hated it, well, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me. So as the clock is ticking up, and I'm actually going to make it on time today, to 6:50 Pacific time. We're going to have to say goodbye, but I want you to stay tuned to the next show with Matt Duffin. It starts at 7 p.m. Pacific time, and I will see you on December 6th. Remember to bring noisemakers so we can celebrate my birthday on December 7th. And, so on that note, I want to say once more, thank you, Harriet Hodgson, author of 42 books, including The Family Caregiver's Guide and A Journey for Family Caregivers. Folks, check them out. You'll enjoy them, I hope, as much as I did. So, Harriet, thank you again so much for joining us tonight. And I hope everything goes well, and we'll definitely keep in touch online.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody. See you in 3 weeks this time. Bye-bye.